From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tine. Today on the show, how has the idea of the presidential mandate changed from FDR's day to the Obama presidency? Later, Wisconsin native Linda Balgord relishes her role in the touring company of Phantom of the Opera.
It's an adventure. That's kind of how I look at it. I mean, at this point in my life, getting to go out. I haven't toured in 17 years since I did Sunset Boulevard. So for me, it's kind of playtime.
And the hero of Patricia Skalka's new mystery is a reluctant transplant to Door County.
At the beginning of the book, when he gets there, he's not happy. He feels like it's all been a mistake. So part of the story is his evolution as someone coming to feel that Door County really is his new home.
Lake Effect is next, after this news update. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tike. Thank you so much for tuning in today. There is no doubt we live in a highly politicized, highly polarized time. As we enter the midterm elections, there are a number of Republican candidates who are running with a promise of trying to impeach President Obama in the last 2 years of his term. A variety of challenges, both foreign and domestic, have President Obama's popularity at a low point, even among people who have historically supported him. It's a far cry from the mandate that the president and his political allies cited after his reelection 2 years ago. But what would constitute a mandate anyway? And how have presidents used the idea of a mandate to justify policy? Julia Azari tackles those questions in a new book called Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate. Azari, who is assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, joins us in the studio now to talk more about mandates. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the nature of mandates in general here. The mandates are not a recent concept, but what is more recent is how its use has kind of evolved in more recent years.
Correct. I first got interested in the subject of mandates when I was a graduate student, and the question came up kind of in the, in the shadow of the 2004 election. The question came up about what constitutes a large enough victory to be a mandate, right? Are some victories special? And if so, what's the threshold? So if some elections really confer some unique and special authority on the president or on any elected official for that matter, is the cutoff 50%? Is it a majority? Is it 55%? How do we determine that?
Well, and let me ask you a potentially dumb question. I mean, I think this is what you're getting at. Is there any way to separate a mandate from mandate rhetoric, or is a mandate really something that only exists in rhetorical terms?
I think it's something that only exists in rhetorical terms. I will hedge about a lot of things, but I will say that unequivocally. I think that it is very difficult to take millions of votes and come up with some kind of meaningful picture out of that. The meaningful picture comes out of how we come to understand that, of the narrative that's spun out of that. And presidents are uniquely positioned to build that narrative. They obviously have a national stage. Rhetoric is a big part of what they do. But also presidents are uniquely positioned to need that narrative to justify what they're doing. And that's what I found. So stuck in this kind of intractable web of, well, how much is a mandate? What could possibly be a mandate? You get in this kind of thing. And so theorists and political scientists say there's no such thing as a mandate. But every 4 years, and increasingly now I think every 2 years after midterms, after gubernatorial races, everybody rushes to the question of, well, what did it mean? And is it a mandate? And so you have this kind of disconnection there between this concept that's really resonant. And if we're not voting for the government to do something in particular, then what are we doing? And yet these kinds of more thorny questions at the root. So I kind of said, why mess with this question when we could just look at how do presidents use this? And that's where I found a story that was a lot different than what I think a lot of people would expect.
Right. And I think as you turn back the clock and look at the early half, or really the first two-thirds of the 20th century, the concept of a mandate as it was used by presidents was a great deal different than we think of it today.
It was. So on the one hand, this book really focuses on the change that occurred in the late 20th century, where I find a real uptick in mandate rhetoric and in the importance of the mandate in presidential governance and the way that presidents not only talk about the mandate in national speeches to the electorate, but also to other people who are in government, to members of Congress, when they're addressing members of their own executive branch, also when they're out in the world and they're addressing and they're making a kind of local address to a smaller audience. I find that mandate rhetoric really kind of comes to the fore in a way that it didn't during the years of FDR, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson. But at the same time, I also find there's a kind of recurring pattern in the presidency, which is that presidents are constantly pushing at the boundaries of their authority. They're constantly doing things that are challenged by their opponents as really being outside of what the presidency should do or what presidents should do. And this goes back to Andrew Jackson and his contest with Congress over the Bank of the United States. And he used the mandate to justify his strong actions then. And then I find this pattern recurs through the 20th century. Franklin Roosevelt talked very little about the mandate after the 1932 election. He talked a lot about the crisis and about solving the crisis of the Depression. But when things started to get a little bit more challenging for him, after his second election, he was inaugurated again in 1937. At that point, the Supreme Court had invalidated a number of the important New Deal statutes. And Roosevelt was starting to fight back by threatening to change the structure of the Supreme Court. So he goes to Congress and has this proposal to reorganize the judiciary, to expand the court for every member over 70. And that's really received badly as a kind of dictatorial overreach. And that's when FDR starts trotting out mandate rhetoric. But it's not just – so the story about FDR I think is pretty interesting on its own. But then we see this occur over and over again. This happens with Richard Nixon, a kind of famous overstepper, where he refers to the mandate and to the election of – both the elections of 1968, which was a very narrow victory, and then 72, which was a broad victory, in the context of fights with Congress over the budget, fights with Congress and with, you know, with any number of opponents over Watergate. He used the idea of the 1972 mandate to defend himself against those charges. And what I argue is that in the wake of the Vietnam War – and Watergate and this kind of new public understanding of the danger of strong executive power, presidents are now kind of always dealing with this boundary situation and are in a much more defensive posture all the time than they were in the middle of the 20th century when public trust in the government and in the presidency was much higher, where the parties were much less polarized. And so to deal with this much more challenging and defensive environment, presidents have turn to mandate rhetoric, and that turn is really unrelated to election victory magnitude.
You point to Dwight Eisenhower as perhaps emblematic of presidents who sought to have broad appeal mm-hmm. without necessarily invoking this idea of a mandate. Here's a guy who was elected fairly easily, but he did not necessarily invoke the idea that he had a mandate in trying to bring broad appeal to his policies.
Right. Eisenhower was pretty reserved about claiming mandates. He talked a bit about his campaign in 1953. After the 1956 election, he really didn't talk very much about mandates at all. And one time a reporter asked him and he told the reporter that, you know, he was embarrassing him. And, you know, a very Eisenhower-like deflection. And so there's some degree, as I was looking at these different presidents, there's some degree you see their personal styles come through. But even beyond the personal styles, there are also these patterns where presidents who are near each other in time, even when they're different in every other conceivable way, have some similar mandate claiming habits.
This is like Bush and Obama mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, Bush and Obama, Carter and Nixon, and Eisenhower and LBJ. Those I look at those pairs in the book. With Bush and Obama, they're my two biggest mandate claimers after the elections of 2004 and 2008. Those are really – these are obviously two really different individuals. In some ways, the elections have some commonalities because they're both – kind of easily spun as party victories. But both presidents really make a lot of that. Whereas, you know, in contrast, in 1953, when Eisenhower was taking office for the first time, we had a kind of similar situation where the Republicans did really well. And Eisenhower really was much more reserved about making that case that the electorate had rejected Democratic policies, which was a big theme that Obama sounded a lot in 2009. He didn't talk so much about specific things he promised on the campaign trail. A lot of his references occurred in the context of either they were very broad, very general, or they occurred in the context of news interviews. One thing I'd like to say just about kind of the way – you know, putting the book together that was fun was that after I created this larger data set of mandate rhetoric, I went to six presidential libraries. So I've got all of these kind of stories from the speechwriters and White House staffers and communications leaders within the different presidential administrations. And so the book really tries to go into and get a feel for, after the election had occurred and after the president took office, what did they really – you know, what were people saying about the election and what were they saying about the political challenges that they faced? Not just what do we remember now that everything's been nicely tied up by history, but what were they saying at the time? And especially for some of these older ones, looking back at the Johnson administration and at the Eisenhower administration, the way that their employees and their White House – their White Houses were looking at problems is a lot different than how we remember them in some instances.
Do you think – is there a danger to governing in mandate rhetoric? Does it paint a president into a corner, if you will?
I think that it does. I think that the normative implications, the kind of how the world should be of this book are a little bit disturbing. First of all, the kind of governing from a place of defensiveness all the time isn't great. When we complain about presidents not having leadership or vision, this is kind of, I think, at the heart of that problem. There is a degree of painting into the corner, and I've been thinking a lot about this as Obama has been trying to deal with various situations in the Middle East. He campaigned with a specific idea about how he was going to conduct policy, and then events intervened. Undoubtedly, he learned new security information after taking office. Sometimes the mandate is kind of at odds with being pragmatic. Which, you know, there's a real contrast there if we look at FDR, who was all about experiments and solving problems, and his rhetoric was very much about that. Contemporary presidents, not so much. The other problem is that it kind of passes the buck to the electorate. You know, Truman said the buck stops here, but when presidents justify their decisions in terms of what they promised they would do and what they were elected to do, it kind of puts the decision in the hands of the voters in a way that it sounds democratic. But, you know, there's a way of thinking about democracy that's kind of about, you know, we elect leaders and we want leaders to exercise good judgment and to lead. And I feel like that has kind of fallen out, at least of presidential discourse over the last 30 years or so.
Well, and at the heart of this, when you go to the polling place and you flip a lever or you push a button or otherwise check a box, you're electing a person. It's not a laundry list of issues that you're necessarily signing off on.
Right. One thing that's interesting about that is that the development of mandate rhetoric has really kind of been about this parliamentarization of presidential politics. So, you know, in some countries that is what you do. You vote for a party, and sometimes you can't even see the candidates on the list, right? You just vote for the party. And American politics has traditionally been really resistant to that. But there's no question that our party system has become more issue-oriented, more polarized. And that presidents have become much more dependent on their parties for support. Obviously, opposition's become a lot more organized. The gap between the president's, you know, party supporters and those in the opposite party in terms of approval is huge. And it wasn't always. So there's a lot going on there in terms of this becoming more like that system. And yet that's not the system we have in place. And the presidency is really not designed to operate that way.
At the heart of all this, there is an inherent irony that the times when a mandate might truly exist in which the president is popular and has the greatest support are the times in which the idea of a mandate is invoked the least and vice versa. So if you say you have a mandate, you probably don't.
That seems to kind of, I mean, this gets again at the question of do you ever really have a mandate? But I think it's safe to say that if you say you have a mandate, the chances are you're saying it because you feel threatened in some way. And that, right, presidents say this when they're the least popular. Sometimes presidents are popular and their policies aren't, or vice versa, which speaks again to this, the difficulty of really ever determining what a mandate is. But I think that it's right to say that when we hear presidents talking about doing what they were elected to do, based on the research I've done, there was probably a conversation about that that was about problems with public support. It was about the way – how well the opposition was organized, or somehow about, you know, feeling like something wasn't going well. It tends to be defensive rhetoric. And although the patterns in how presidents have talked about mandates have changed, to some extent that is constant.
Where does Congress fall in this equation? I mean, clearly individual congressmen and senators can't claim a national mandate, but the parties seem to employ mandate rhetoric when pushing their own policy agenda.
I think that's right. One of the things that I note in the beginning and end of the book is that I think this is starting to kind of leak out of just the presidential arena. There are reasons why this was kind of a presidential concept at first. Part of that has to do with the national idea. When Andrew Jackson trotted this concept out in the 1830s, it was all about the president being the only person who was elected nationally. But now, as the parties have become more nationalized and as congressional elections and even, I think, gubernatorial elections have become more nationalized, I think I read somewhere that only 30% of Scott Walker's campaign money comes from within the state. And that's undoubtedly true in some other high-profile governor's races this year as well. I think that this concept is becoming more resonant for members of Congress and also in state-level politics. I think that the age of mandate politics has only just begun.
Julia Azari, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Julia Azari's new book is called Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate, published by Cornell University Press. Azari, who teaches political science at Marquette, will talk about the book September 2nd at Boswell Book Company. If the idea of mandate rhetoric is a given in national politics today, the idea of the presumption of innocence has long been a given in the judicial system. Lake Effect essayist Tina Freiberger says that doesn't mean it's always the case.
Imagine you're out walking and a police officer approaches you. He tells you that he has a warrant for your arrest. He handcuffs you and takes you downtown for booking. In the U.S., you are innocent until proven guilty, right? Well, yes, but the fine print matters. The fact is, you can be punished before being found guilty or innocent. In fact, many individuals are not free while they wait for their day in court. Instead, they are incarcerated before being found guilty or innocent, which, as we will hear, creates its own set of problems. Although special stipulations can vary, during this stage, the court can choose between three major options to ensure you return to court. Option number one is release on recognizance. This allows you to return to the court by simply giving your word that you will attend future court appearances. Option two is for the judge to set a bail amount for you, which you, or someone on your behalf, pays to have you released. If you continue through the court process, this money is returned. If you fail to attend court proceedings, the money paid is forfeited. If you cannot afford to pay the bail, however, you must remain incarcerated until you are determined guilty or innocent. Option three is to deny release. If this is imposed, you must remain incarcerated. When deciding which option is most appropriate, the judge considers the potential danger you might pose to the community if released, along with the likelihood that you abscond, or that you'll fail to show up for future court proceedings. If you serve time before trial and are later found guilty, you get credit for the time you served. For example, if you serve 3 months in jail before being found guilty, those 3 months could be subtracted from the term of your final sentence. So let's suppose you are convicted. A 6-month sentence is now a 3-month sentence. If you are found not guilty, however, you have no recourse for the time you served. For those who are convicted, having to spend time in jail prior to being convicted of a crime creates additional problems. Research shows that being incarcerated hinders defendants' abilities to aid in their own defenses, because it makes it more difficult to communicate with their attorneys and plan defense strategies. Even more problematic for these individuals, studies have shown that those who are detained pretrial serve significantly longer sentences than those who had been released prior to sentencing. A study I conducted in a large urban county in Michigan showed that defendants who were detained prior to sentencing received jail sentences that averaged a month and a half longer than those not detained. For those sentenced to prison, the detained individuals received sentences that were almost a year longer. So, all else being equal, prior record, type and severity of offense they committed, race, gender, they served almost one entire year longer than those who were free prior to sentencing. Research indicates that the reasons for these longer sentences are because judges may perceive defendants who are incarcerated prior to sentencing as more dangerous. Also, when individuals are incarcerated prior to conviction, they're more eager to get their cases processed through the system quicker, making them less likely to hold out for a better plea bargain from the district attorney. So, although the presumption of innocence is still the standard in the United States justice system, innocent until proven guilty does not always protect people from being incarcerated before being found guilty or innocent.
Tina Freiberger is associate professor and chair of the Criminal Justice Department in the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee and an occasional Lake Effect contributor. Keep listening. We'll meet a Wisconsin star in the touring company of the Phantom of the Opera opening in Milwaukee this week. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Milwaukee's Marcus Center for the Performing Arts is the home venue for many local performing arts organizations, from the Milwaukee Symphony to the Ballet and the Florentine Opera. But it also hosts performances by any number of national touring companies. Each year, the center unveils its Broadway at the Marcus Center series schedule, featuring performances of big Broadway musicals that people might not see unless they got to travel to New York or London. Opening this week is one of the most celebrated musicals of the last 30 years, and Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Phantom of the Opera has not been out of production since it opened in London in 1986. The production coming to Milwaukee is an updated version, and it features Wisconsin native Linda Balgord playing Madame Giry. Balgord has a long and storied career on stage, starring in many big-name musicals. Lake Effect's Bonnie North reached her by phone on the road, and Balgord talks about her earliest days in theater.
I grew up in New Lisbon, which is a very small town, kind of west central, town of about 1,200 people. I started actually by performing children's storybooks during the library summertime reading program. And I just was always interested in it. I grew up watching Carol Burnett doing comedy sketches. I think I was a bit of a clown. And I had teachers who encouraged me. I mean, if there was no one in the arts in my family, we really had no idea. But, I had a high school English teacher who said, you can go to college for theater. So that's where I started. I went to Viterbo University in La Crosse. And when I graduated from there, I actually worked for a couple of years at the Fireside in Port Atkinson, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with. And while I was there, I met a professor who taught at the Professional Theater Training Program, which was then located at UW-Milwaukee. So I spent 1984 through 1987 in Milwaukee going to graduate school. So I just slowly, it seemed at each turn there was somebody who let me know the next thing I needed to do, because I certainly had no idea how to do it on my own.
Well, and it sounds like also that they saw the talent and that they encouraged you to pursue it.
Yes. No, I was definitely, at every step, I was encouraged, starting with my parents who, were brave enough to believe in me and carrying on many years through many wonderful people.
What is it like for a working actor like yourself to be in a tour like this? And we'll get to the actual show itself, but there's a whole process about touring. I think a lot of people who aren't in the business don't understand how it works.
Well, as far as the day-to-day life of the tour, I mean, it's very interesting. We travel city to city. We do 2 weeks is the shortest stop we have. Some places like Chicago, we were there for 2 months over the winter. We've been in Boston just for 4 weeks right now. We've got 2 more weeks. So you go to these cities. We have company managers. They give us housing options, hotel options. We usually have 2 or 3, but some people go off the sheet and do either from Craigslist or websites. But it's a complicated sort of a lifestyle. In some ways it's simple because you basically have two suitcases and then a trunk, which the company travels for you. But you have to have everything you think you need in that amount of luggage for an extended period of time.
How many months are for you?
Well, I think we're in month 8 right now since we started rehearsal in New York in October. We started performing in November in Providence. So, you know, it's really tricky, especially, you know, a lot of us have spouses and homes. You know, there are young people in the show. I think it's a little easier for them because at that stage in your life, you're still, you know, the gypsy lifestyle that's going. It gets a little more challenging, I think, when you have more of an established life in a place.
So what are the rewards for someone like you, you know, where you're out for a year at a time?
Well, the rewards are that I get to work on this amazing show, this amazing production of The Phantom of the Opera that we're doing. And it's an adventure. That's kind of how I look at it. I mean, at, you know, this point in my life, getting to go out. I haven't toured in 17 years since I did Sunset Boulevard. So for me, it's kind of playtime. You don't have all the responsibilities of keeping up your house. That's left to my poor husband. So you have, in that way, you have less responsibilities, and you get to see a lot of great places, meet a lot of great people.
I would also think that there is the challenge to keeping something fresh, which is true for any long run. But,
absolutely.
But you're having to do it in different theaters, even though you have somewhat of an extended run for a tour. You're not coming in for a night, but you still, you know, you have to learn a new theater each time.
Absolutely. And lots of things change. You know, some theaters have very shallow orchestra pits, so the audience is very close to us. Some have very deep pits, so they're farther away. Where a lot of our lighting instruments end up depend on the physical space of the theater. So things do change from city to city, and it takes adjustment, you know, in lots of areas of the performance, getting used to the different sound in, you know, of course we have our own sound system and we're mic'd, but every theater sounds different, and what we hear is a little different in every city as well. And of course backstage, you know, it's just signs everywhere because, you know, we get into the city, we have our orientation at 5 o'clock, and we have a show that night at 7:30.
So you don't even
know the building.
Wow, you don't even get a dress rehearsal in the new theater?
Not at this point, no.
Wow.
No, we don't. You know, everybody knows the show. I mean, honestly, the people that's hardest on are the local crew and the local dressers that we hire. They get handed a sheet of instructions for each actor they dress. It's made easier now because all the actors know what they need to wear and when. But, I mean, it's really, the first couple of shows are, you know, everybody's a little bit on tenterhooks. You know?
It can be a little bit chaos backstage, yeah.
A little bit, yes, yeah. Yes. Hopefully the audience has no idea that's going on.
Well, yes, hopefully not. Phantom of the Opera, 25 years that this has been going on around the world. I mean, it's not just in one place. How is it for you being in such an iconic musical? I mean, it's one of the musicals that really defined the last 20 years, 25 years of the last century.
Absolutely. It's thrilling. I've long wanted to be a part of this show. And this production, which was directed by Lawrence Connor, it was first done as a tour in the UK. Cameron really, you know, they really decided to take a fresh look at Phantom. It has a completely new set design, which I promise you, your people who come to the show are going to see and believe that we can tour the set because it's huge. It's really amazing. We're one of the two largest touring shows on the road in the U.S. right now. It's a beautiful set, and it's so interesting how what I really like about the production is that you really see the changing from on stage to off stage in the theater. And I think it gives a beautiful sense of the backstage life at the Opera House, which is great for me because my character is Madame Giry, the ballet mistress, so she is a creature of the backstage. She's not a performer. And also, it still has the beautiful score, which is, you know, probably one of the main things that made the show the icon that it is the lush romantic melodies. And it still has the beautiful costumes designed by Maria Bjornsson. It's a different look at the show, Phantom. I think is a really smart and an interesting and a genuine world that we've created.
So people who might have seen it, say, in New York or mm-hmm. on tour or right. whatever, will they be surprised by some of the changes, or is it still going to feel like the show that they know?
It's definitely the show that they know. The settings are different. All the things that they expect still happen. They go to the Phantom's lair, you know, where he takes Christine. But it's a very different journey than in the original production. Every bit is thrilling, but different. I mean, it's really interesting to talk to people who have seen both productions because they really love the new production in that it makes them see things in a different way and see things that they may not have seen before.
Is that true for the cast as well? I'm sure most of you have seen it at some point
right.
or another. Yeah. Does that help you, the fact that this is a different take on it?
When we started, we were all new to the production. The production was new, and we were all new. And the rehearsal process was done as a rehearsal process for any new show. So it wasn't as if, okay, here this is what the manager Andre does, or here this is what Christine does. I mean, it was really approached as a new show. And therefore, the artistic freedom was wonderful. And that really made it for all of us a really great journey.
Once you're done with Milwaukee, where do you go after that?
Then we're off to Dallas, Texas.
For how long? You're here a couple of weeks, or?
We're in Milwaukee, right, from July 23rd to August 3rd. And then we head off to Dallas, Texas. We're there for 3 weeks August. Yes.
You're hoping that the air conditioning is working in the theater.
I think they probably get air conditioning down there.
I think so.
Guess.
Yeah. So how long is this tour scheduled to run, and has it been extended? Do you have any idea about that at this point?
You know, we have dates through, I think there are dates on the website through the beginning of 2015. Beyond that, I don't know. But I think that it's very popular, and I'm sure it will go at least a couple of years.
Do you want to stay with it that whole time?
Oh, that's so hard to say. You know, it's, most of the principal years will be coming up at the end of November. And it's difficult to say still, I think, until, you know, a decision has to be made. I can't possibly say. But we are very excited about coming to Milwaukee. I know we're there in the midst of many festivals.
Yes, you are, but it's actually a good time. At least you've got Summerfest out of the way, so
yes,
you're not competing with that. Have you been back to Milwaukee since you were here in the training program?
I haven't been back, and you know, I have not performed in Milwaukee since I left grad school. I've never performed at the Marcus Center, so I'm very excited to get a chance to do that.
So when you come back, is there a place that you want to go find on time off?
Well, you know what? I want to find the house I lived in at grad school. I have to go walk wandering. It's on Hampshire. And I need to go find it and see if it's still there.
Yeah. And you'll look at the city, and I've been here about 8 years, and it's changed in that time. It's been, well, we won't say how long, but it's been since the late 80s. You know, it has changed quite a lot.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, it must have. It absolutely must have. And I have so many friends there. You know, a lot of people that I went to grad school with still work in the area. And it'll be really, really wonderful to get an opportunity to be in the area again.
You know, well, welcome back. You know, I won't say welcome home because it wasn't home, but, you know, it's sort of a beginning of an artistic home, perhaps.
Yes. Absolutely. And honestly, you know, whenever I'm in Wisconsin, you know, it does have the feel of home. Certainly, you know, the warmth of the people and the beauty of the region, it really, it does make me feel at home.
Well, Linda, best of luck. Break a leg on the show.
You.
And we're looking forward to seeing you on the stage of the Marcus Center for the first time.
Oh, that's great. It's just terrific. And I promise anyone who comes, you're going to be thrilled.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Bonnie.
Linda Balgord plays Madame Giry in the national touring company of The Phantom of the Opera, which opens Wednesday at the Marcus Center for the Performing Arts. Balgord is a Wisconsin native and earned her MFA at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with Bonnie North. One last break, and then death and mayhem in an unlikely place, Door County. Fortunately, it is fiction. We'll learn more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Wisconsin is fortunate enough to have one of the most popular destination areas for vacationers in the country. Door County is known for its rustic elegance, its natural beauty, its jams and jellies, its cherries. It's also known for peace and serenity. Author Patricia Skalka has been traveling to Door County for nearly 30 years. She and her family have a rustic cottage where they stay to enjoy the serenity and the county's culture. But her long periods of time there got her to thinking, what about the dark side of Door County? Enter Dave Kubiak, a character Skalka created to explore that dark side while having a dark side of his own. Kubiak, a former Chicago detective, relocates to Door County to get away from all the death and mayhem he's encountered in his life. What he didn't expect was to find more death than mayhem in Door County. There's a murderer on the loose. In Skalka's new mystery novel, Death Stalks Door County. Skalka, who is a former writer for Reader's Digest, joined Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson by phone and explained what draws her to writing, whether it's fiction or journalism.
I think you need people who are credentialed, who know how to get the information that is necessary to share with the public. I mean, it's an essential role. I mean, I think it's fine that in the kind of media we have today that many people are able to express opinions or shed the light on events and incidents and that may not otherwise be known to the general public, but I still think you need people who have that additional layer of expertise and really know how to pull things together.
So an expertise in just writing for nonfiction, or you're also referring to fiction writers, novelists, mystery writers, all kind of writers?
All kind of writers. I really believe that. You know, it's nice that people have the means to express their ideas, to bring their stories to light. I think it's marvelous that, you know, you can do memoirs, you can produce your own short stories, you can publish just about anything you want. But I still think that there's a definite space, an area, a need for people who have just a little bit more of a level of expertise. And maybe it comes from experience, or maybe it just comes from some innate talent. I mean, some people are just born being better storytellers than other people, whether they're telling the stories verbally or putting them down in writing. But a lot of it just comes from doing it again and again and again and learning as you go.
So with your vast amount of experience ranging from the Reader's Digest to being a ghostwriter, when planning out the end product, how does writing fiction such as mysteries differ from writing nonfiction such as medical interest stories?
Well, there are many similarities insofar as you have to have the concept of going full circle. In other words, you have to bring the reader to a solution that feels right, that feels like the story has been completed in the way it should be. And I always did that when I did nonfiction, and then I tried to do that in my fiction as well. They differ insofar as when you're doing nonfiction, you're really limited to what you learn or what you are told, what you're able to pull from a source or to gather on your own. When you're doing fiction, the world is your oyster because it's your imagination, and you can just go anywhere with it.
Is that a benefit to writing fiction, being where you can create your own product, or does that kind of hinder it because there's just so many options that you can choose from?
Oh, I think it's a benefit because it allows you to kind of pick your own path. And I mean, you can adhere to a stricter storyline, or you can be more creative. You can just about do anything you want with it. But I think you still have to have a sense of some grounding in reality. And in other words, your dialogue has to sound unrealistic. You don't want it to be like plastic or forced. And, you know, your descriptions have to be something that people can, that your readers can absorb and really kind of latch on to. If you start describing things that are too outlandish or too absurd, then I think you lose your audience. So you need kind of a measure of both.
You recently released your new book, Death Stalks Door County, and this is the first of the Dave Kubiak mysteries. And with this, you are taking a man who is originally lived in Chicago and has recently moved up to the Green Bay, Door County area. So how much research did you have to do for those two cities?
Well, I mean, I live in Chicago, so that was not an issue. And I have friends who are Chicago cops and former Chicago cops. So, you know, I've listened to their stories and heard about their experiences and, you know, could turn to them for guidance when I needed it. And I've spent so much time up in Door County that I had, you know, a working knowledge of the terrain and of the people. I talked to the sheriff there, Terry Vogel, who was extremely helpful. Sort of laying out the guidelines for the way they do things and where the parameters are. I explained to him what I was doing and where I maybe pushed the envelope a little bit. And he said, well, you know, that's okay. We do it this way, but this is fiction. And so there was a certain amount of research, but the story, the basic storyline, came from my own imagination and from my own sense of the kind of complex story I wanted to weave. I wanted to have someone who was a newcomer trying to delve into the intricacies of an area where people are known to each other and where stories and family histories go back generations and things are complex. And he's looked upon as someone who is not necessarily privy to the secrets and yet he has to know what the background is, what the history is, in order to solve the crime.
You actually have experience in Door County, do you not?
Yes, I do. I've been going up to Door County for more than 30 years now, and have a family has a summer cottage up there, one of those quaint old, classic, rustic, you know, but casual, charming places, and spent a lot of time there. Much of my book was written sitting on the front porch, looking out over Lake Michigan.
Because the protagonist, Dave Kubiak, who we've been talking about, just recently left his job as a Chicago police detective and is now an assistant park ranger in Door County, where you're saying about how people have been going back for generations. They all know each other. They're somehow almost related in between the two different families or multiple families. Would you say that Dave is running away, or is he getting a fresh start from his past in Chicago?
Well, he's doing both. He is running away from a tragic past. His wife and his daughter have been killed in an accident that he feels that he should have been able to prevent. So he's just burdened, not just with grief, but with tremendous amount of guilt. So he is trying to get away from that, but he's also trying to make a new start. It's a friend who urged him to be retrained as a ranger when he went back to school. It's a friend who pointed him in the direction of this job. And so he views it as a new start. But at the beginning of the book, when he gets there, he's not happy. He feels like it's all been a mistake. So part of the story is his evolution as someone coming to feel that Door County really is his new home. But it takes a while for that to happen. And he also has to come to terms with his own past before he can before he can face the reality of what's happening, because people are dying, and he's trying to just not be involved. He's resisting being involved because he's had too much death in his life, personally and professionally, and he doesn't want any. He's tired of it. He wants to get away from death, and yet it turns out, you know, and as the book evolves, that he is the one person who understands what's happening, who has an objective sense about it, and who can follow the clues and resolve what's happening. So it really is. He has to accept his responsibility to, in effect, continue serving and protect. The motto of the Chicago Police is to serve and protect. And he realizes at some point that he has to do this.
Because throughout the book, we come to realize that some of these people that he's been working with throughout the town, including the sheriff and the coroner and other city administrators, just kind of want to live in denial and want to write off these deaths as accidental or suicidal. But why are they drawing these conclusions?
Well, for one thing, there is not a lot of murder going. I mean, that's a part of the country that is spared a lot of the violence that occurs in other places. So death isn't, you know, murder and killing are not really something that happens on a daily or weekly or monthly basis or even an annual basis up there. But also it's the tourist season is about to begin, and they, you know, Door County depends very, very heavily. The economy depends on the tourist dollar. And you don't want anything, and this would happen anywhere, not just in an area like Door County, but any place that depends on people coming in to spend time, spend money. You don't want to have anything that's going to discourage them and sort of cause them to go elsewhere. So it's sort of an act of self-protection, really. And I think it's hard when you live somewhere where life is really just almost pleasant and positive on a daily basis. It's hard to face the fact that something horrible is happening in your midst. You know, denial is a very natural kind of human characteristic.
One of the things I really like about Dave is just how quiet and reserved he is, especially at the beginning. And I think it was best, he was best described when another character named Beck was referring to him and comparing him to the old adage, the still water runs deep. And he's very quiet, but he understands exactly what is going on, like you had mentioned before. That seems like he's the only one who is involved, who knows what happened and is not in denial.
Absolutely. But that's his dilemma, because he is aware of that, and yet he doesn't want to get involved. He's waiting for someone else to pick up the charge, as it were. He's waiting for someone else to step up and say, okay, you know, we've got a problem, and this is how we have to solve it. This is what we need to do. And nobody does that.
And you have four more Dave Kubiak's mysteries coming up. What can we look forward to in these future mysteries?
Well, the theme that I had running, you know, right from the beginning is that you have an event that occurs in the present day, but it's always linked to something that goes back years or generations, that there's always the initial germ of the problem or the issue goes back a long time. And so there's a matter of going through layers and digging through these past eras to find out what the motive is, what the reason is, and who the killer is. So that will happen in the next several stories. They're all linked to past events. But, you know, these are not like crimes of passion or crimes of the moment.
But they are going to be still set in Door County, or are you going to...
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. They're all a Door County series, and that's going to be the locale. He may have to travel a bit around. In fact, in one, he will travel throughout the state, but the story is based in Door County, and in one, he will actually have to travel out of the country, but it's because of events that start in Door County.
All right. And do you have a couple of book signings coming up?
Actually, I do. I've had several already. I've done signings in Door County. I've done signings in Chicago that have been very, very well received. But I have some coming up in Sturgeon Bay and in Fish Creek. And I've got one coming up in Manitowoc also. And I'm scheduling some in the Milwaukee area. So there's lots to do. And I've had some in Madison. I've got one coming up in Lodi, one coming up in Green Bay. So there's going to be a lot of exposure to readers. And I've actually been just delighted by the interest. I'll tell you just one story. I was talking to someone who runs a very popular gift shop up in Door County and showing her the book and telling her about it. And she was deciding whether or not she wanted to carry it in her shop. And a group of people came in and someone looked at the book and just bought it.
Wow.
So she said, oh, okay. I think I'll take a few. But that's kind of the reception that's been happening. And
I was at Printer's Row in Chicago earlier in June, and I have an enlargement. There's a map in the book of Door County, and I have an enlargement of that on display, and I had the cover of the book on display. And it was just amazing how many people were just drawn, like by a magnet. They recognized immediately it's a very distinctive geographic layout. And they would come over and say, oh, that's where we stayed, or that's where our cottage is, or that's where my, mother grew up. Or it was just amazing to me how people were just drawn to it.
So then was the cover of your book taken at your cottage, then, or?
No, the cover of the book is actually a scene that is set in Peninsula State Park. There's the top of that wonderful tower and looking out into the bay and then to Horseshoe Island in the distance. So that is taken over on my cottage is on the Lake Michigan side, and this is the cover of the book is on the Green Bay side.
So these places are pretty pivotal to the storyline of Deathstalk Door County then.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Patricia Skalka, thank you so much for being on Lake Effect.
Well, I'm just delighted to, and I would just like to say that your listeners can find the book locally at Boswell Books, at the Barnes & Noble stores in the area, including the one at the Bayshore Mall, Book World in Maquon, and, of course, it's available online as well.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Chicago author Patricia Skalka's recent mystery is called Deathstalks Door County, the first book in the Dave Kubiak series published by the University of Wisconsin Press. She spoke with Lake Effect Eleanor Peterson. Skalka has several readings scheduled and points to the north in the next month. You will find a link to a list from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's all for the Monday edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, we'll check in with our foreign policy contributor on the things happening overseas, including Ukraine and the Middle East, and much, much more. Hope you can tune in for that, and I hope you can join us each weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're your NPR station in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Coming up at noon today, it's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR in Boston. But right now, it is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.